Okay, if I can have everybody's attention, we're going to call this meeting to order. And
the microphone on?
Yeah, it should be. I'd like to welcome everybody here tonight. As I have mentioned before, this is the High School Redesign Work Group. We have been meeting for a couple of months, and we are an interim work group. And as I have mentioned before, because of that, because of our status of being a work group, we do not have the ability to pass any bills out of this committee. But we are a study work group, and many of the members have been asking me, what is going to be then the outcome of this group? And so I did just want to let all the stakeholders know, as we do, we will produce a report. And the second thing that will, and so that will be the outcome number one. And the second thing is that the members would like to work together on some sort of a comprehensive bill on high school redesign. And we'll be working on that in the weeks to come. So those are the two things that we will be striving for out of this committee. And with that, I just wanted to mention one other thing. Because we are such a small group and a work group, we have been inviting all the stakeholders to come and sit around the table. And so those of you in the audience, we would welcome you down at the table. I think it makes for a much nicer conversation, especially for the person testifying. That's right. You never know. We might keep you here. Just a few statements that I'd like to make here tonight. We have, I know there are a couple other members that are coming, and so they will be trickling in. But just for some level of context here, we have focused much discussion in this work group on high school redesign. And we've taken a look at what's going on in the country, in other states, a little bit in the world, but we've really focused on a lot of what is already going on in some of our schools, and to one extent or another. And tonight we are going to take a little bit more of a turn on this. We are going to look a little more globally as to what is going on from the global perspective. And as I've told other people, I think tonight is just going to be just a little bit more of a radical approach to high school redesign, which we welcome with open arms. We've all got very open minds, don't we, members?
We do.
So with that, Dr. Arthur Harkins from the University of Minnesota is an education futurist, and he is going to be our first testifier tonight. Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. I think what we want to do is actually share this presentation between me and John Moravec. John Moravec is a recent doctorate from the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota, and he's also the new director of the LeapFrog Institute program, which was just funded and is underway at the university. So, yes, our approach is more global. We see high school, middle school, grade school, preschool, and college and postgraduate education rather in the same framework. Our problem, I think, worldwide is the question, how do you create knowledge out of these systems rather than merely expend or dispense knowledge? And how do you create innovation out of that knowledge that you generate in these systems? So that's our approach, basically, and we call it a leapfrog approach, basically bringing the future into the present. And also, we like to think of it as an exercise in living, learning, and working in the unpredictable environment of change. Something that, when I was in school, was never discussed. We were always going to live in a world, essentially, it was an extension of the present, rather than something new or totally new, even. So there is a huge opportunity awaiting all of our students and faculty, and for that matter, our citizens, to exercise the opportunity of living, learning, and working in futures that they, in fact, create. And as the decentralization of responsibility for one's life occurs in this society, in all sectors, including especially health, we would expect that extension of personal choice to go into the realms of education at all levels. So we can imagine a great deal of individualization occurring in the fairly near future in American education, individualization that in many public schools does not exist except in the exceptional circumstances of students with behavioral problems. So leapfrogging, as we define it, is bringing preferred futures into a present that welcomes those futures. Now, what this requires is that the present not be seen singularly, but plurally. Every one of us has a different worldview. Every one of us, therefore, has a different present, past, and future. So if we start looking at the way in which this kind of diversity can express itself, we can parallel our present system of essentially industrially modeled education with another kind of model, which is basically an individualization model, which enables us to create more diversity and ideally to expend effort to create innovation out of some of that diversity. So the leapfrog principles are several in number. We have a handout that you have in front of you. I want to say before I turn this over to John that the handout you have in front of you is a working document. It will be about half the length it currently is when it goes into a journal. The journal is the World Futures Society Journal Futures Research Quarterly, which will produce a special issue of two Anglo writers, John and myself, three actually, John, myself, and another person, and four Chinese writers, all of them writing on different aspects of leapfrog. The entire journal issue to be translated to Mandarin this spring and used as a core reading for two national Chinese conferences in the fall, one of them specifically on leapfrog and how to implement it in teacher training and in community development, and the other a more academically oriented approach to leapfrog and teacher preparation, in which research and theory are stressed over direct application. So John, do you want to take it from here for a while?
Sure, I'll take it. My throat's full of scratchy, so let me get a shot. Now, leapfrog is really about taking on leadership rather than catching up. And now, as long as you're catching up, you'll never be in the lead, you never create the newest stuff. You're always following somebody else, which means that in a knowledge-based economy, you're not the knowledge producer. You're the knowledge follower. It means developing a liberal skills. What this means is that it's the applied aspects of liberal arts and liberal arts education. You can have a liberal arts education, but then there's the so what factor, the so what values of it, and then how do you apply that and develop that so that you're able to approach new situations and abstract futures much better than a person who didn't have experience with the liberal skills or mastery of. Also means that your leadership in developing new knowledge and innovating and innovatively applying the liberal skills and knowledge to solving new problems and creating, and from there creating new innovations and new contextual applications from that. And we start off with, now, leapfrogging is not about catching up with the workforce. Oftentimes, leapfrogging means teaming with the workforce. In education, this means that we can have youth and adults working together to solving problems. Now, since we presented this point at Edison High School in Minneapolis, then we thought, you know, we could do even better than that, because it really means that we're leading the workforce within education. Because if we're creating an innovative workforce, we're able to lead the workforce in the future. And they're able to do so immediately.
Okay. The idea here is to create creative people, to enhance human capital in the United States from very early ages on by involving children and youth in contributing to communities and workforces. Now, what this means, basically, is a transformation in the relationship of youth to adults. In the 18th century, when the United States was primarily an agricultural economy, youth, children worked on the farms, family farms, as essentially members of the productive side of the economy. Somehow during the industrial age, after the passage of labor laws protecting children, they were cut out of that. And what we essentially cut out are reduced to low-wage kinds of circumstances. We want to bring them in now to full participation again in the intellectual creative economy. We think that can be done from whatever age a particular child is ready to do it. So we want to bond children, youth, and adults in new productive ways to develop an innovation society. The phrase innovation society was very strange 5 years ago, but you will find it all over the place today. And we want to do this in the context of global collaboration. So, for example, currently we have relationships with two universities in China. We are developing a relationship with the Chinese Teachers Association and with the Communist Party in an indirect way, because we think that they are behind our successes in working with Chinese universities. We are also looking at South America. We currently have contacts with and active developments with 13 Latin American countries. We have been invited to South Korea, Singapore, and Japan. So we have a sense that this whole idea of bringing youth and adults together productively in a manner reminiscent of the 17th or 18th century farm economy in the United States makes sense to a lot of people. And we think that this process of youth, children, and adults working together around the world and working interactively with each other around the globe can help create a just and viable global economy. So to that end, our college has funded, John is director of Leapfrog Institute, which is a kind of a stimulating, I think, a catalytic organization designed to help people start thinking about this around the world. So we just got the website up yesterday. That's how new all of this is. And we have many indications of interest from around the world, and we think that the Leapfrog Institutes, which are locally controlled and locally designed and defined, have a real future. Now, on the question of money, we don't think we should spend any money on this particular. Our approach this morning, for example, at Edison High School, which is interested in starting something called, tentatively, the Edison Innovation Institute, is to use volunteers, weekends, weeknights, and summers, and the web as sort of a extracurricular analog, an environment in which Leapfrog activities can take place without a lot of pressure against the existing system.
Please. I think also a lot of it is also leveraging existing technologies that we have, that we've invested in, and using them purposefully in new contexts to do new things. We pointed out earlier today that we had a meeting in a rather, kind of indiscreet classroom, which had all the technology needed there to have collaborative learning experiences with other youth around the world. And so it's the purposive use of these technologies in new ways that allows us to really innovate.
We've seen films of Chinese high school students taking examinations with the assistance of web-enabled boxes. We think this is the way of the future. And we think it is because the workforce is already going there, and we think that it is because it doesn't make sense to let people go through 30 years of life preparing to become contributors. We think contributions can occur with the right kind of use of technology at very, very early ages. By the way, what they told us this morning, and we knew this already, of course, was that most high schools collect electronic devices at the door from students and return them to them when they leave the building. We cannot comprehend this in a society that's literally making its living off these devices. So the visions of past, present, or future are where we're interested in going, but we want to do that decentralized way, individualized way, or if you like, a microcultural way. So the given high school, the microculture might do it one way, and individuals might do it another. We also want to acknowledge the pluralism of the real world. Instead of the real world, we need to start talking about real world plural, which means that everyone has a different reality. And that is just simply not part of the recognition structure of an industrially oriented public school system. So using these new technologies ubiquitously, that means everywhere, and creatively and purposefully, through networked Leapfrog Institutes is where we are coming from. And we are terribly excited about this, and we're terribly excited about the possibility of developing, including in our own university, parallel service systems, in other cases parallel schools, that can serve these functions. We don't see any institution in society that cannot possibly, in some productive way, use this approach, connecting persons, families, workplaces, and communities through these kinds of systems, hardware, software, netware, and above all, mindware. Volunteers will be critical, and above all, we don't want to compete with public education. It's an impermeable system. It cannot be cracked, cannot be substantially changed without huge Sturm und Drang. And why go through that? Why not just parallel it, let the sort of customer movement make the decisions about where to go?
Again, you know, the history of education, the past educational reform, the past 100 years, and it's always been educational reform, that we haven't accomplished anything quite yet. So why compete with that?
We're working with District 287, which is 13 districts in the western suburbs and northwestern suburbs. Their project with us, as we are now conceiving it with them, is a series of courses staged from elementary through undergraduate school on teaching kids how to think. Could we see a show of hands? How many people in this room have ever had a course on how to think? One. Two. That's more than we've ever found before. We certainly never have, either of us. If we mean by learning how to think different things, we can certainly find that out in the discussion. And, of course, teaching adults how to innovate through the action of children, particularly in the technology areas, is part of what we're about.
How to think as well.
Yeah, how to think as well. And getting a head start on ourselves, including everyone else, in other words, leapfrogging our own limitations and helping to create the 22nd century. Because the 21st century, folks, is not the only platform from which to view our decision options today. The best decisions are looked at not only from the contemporary platform, but from past and distant futures. So past forward, future backward, centering on alternatives in the present seems to us the way to go right now, right here in Minnesota, to create what we call the second Minnesota miracle. First is financial, this is intellectual, and
innovative.
And thank you very much.
Questions? I'm so glad I characterized this as radical.
John, I was just wondering if you would introduce yourself and what your role in all this is. I only have Dr. Harkin's name.
Right. You know, I came at the last minute here. The College of Education and Human Development has just funded me to work on assembling the Leapfrog Institute, which would be a collection of Leapfrog Institutes that we have locally and globally to look at how we can innovate within education and to coordinate between them, foster communication, and really find best practices that we can to enhance global education as we move forward towards global knowledge and innovation economies.
Your name is?
It's John Moravec.
Yeah. I should have said that I was inviting John to come with tonight. But at the time when you asked me to come here, we were not funded. But in the last few days, we have been funded, and John has been formally appointed to this position, so I thought it appropriate.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question?
Sure.
You had mentioned that today you had worked with the school. Would you give me, in concrete terms, what you did?
Yes, we went through this particular presentation, a slightly different version of it, and then we had our fourth or fifth discussion with that group. This has been going on now since last fall. And we arrived at a set of possibilities, one of which is that within the next few weeks they will create a core task force of faculty and staff. That core task force may also include some rather economically well-endowed people. We will work with them to set up a series of summer activities. Primarily, they would be workshop activities for teachers. In the fall, those workshop activities would be expressed at another level through specific projects yet to be determined, one of which is to involve with District 287 in creating the courses on how to think. Another of which would be to utilize some parts of the building in Edison to create entrepreneurial environments for kids to begin to work with faculty and volunteers to create businesses.
And those skunk works may emerge as early as this summer. So within the next couple weeks, meeting with this core group of faculty to set the vision and then the agenda for that, but they want to move real quick on this and roll it in the summer.
I'm sure they have. Thank you. You had mentioned in your testimony, Doctor, that or John, that the title of this subcommittee is Redesign of High Schools.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming you're starting with the assumption that we have given ourselves an impossible task, and you kind of mentioned that you're prepared to bypass the traditional schools because they're impermeable and do not lend themselves to change. Now, I sat as a classroom teacher for 35 years, and emotionally, I could buy into your argument.
Yes, of course.
But it sounds a little too pessimistic to me.
Oh. You see, if the legislature and others want to reform the K-12 system, it's fine. That's not our primary interest. Our primary interest is to get entrepreneurial, knowledge-creating, innovative pockets of viable pockets of development going in the public education context and elsewhere as soon as possible, internationally, globally. Which means that, for example, if the Chinese Communist Party says there will be a leapfrog movement in all teacher preparation in China after that conference next fall, that will happen.
And so what we're doing is we're really creating, I mean, not by reinventing the system in schools, but by complementing it, paralleling it, we're creating, I mean, our intent is to create pockets of best practices throughout education systems here that we can all learn from and adapt on larger scales and share with others.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The discussion about the direction of the Chinese government to this. It seemed, when I was looking at your outline, that what you're attempting to achieve is an increase in individualism.
Correct.
Do you find it strange that you're relying on an authoritarian or totalitarian government to achieve individualism?
Not in this case. The next one.
Could you explain why?
Yes, because the Chinese have decided that they decided two decades ago that there were going to be a viable entrepreneurial environment. There were several reasons why the party made that decision, among which was to keep down restiveness and so on, but also to give people an opportunity to turn their attention away from their woes into their delights, which make money. And Chinese society has been entrepreneurial for a long, long time prior to the emergence of communism. So they know, they tell us they know, that their society cannot much longer continue to be the manufacturing center of the planet. It's destroying their environment, for one thing. They know that to continue their existence and to raise their status in the world, economically and socially and politically, they're going to have to become an innovation economy. That's why they're interested in what we have today.
Right. If I can offer an alternative or a complementary theory, or maybe it's completely different, I don't know where it places. Chinese authoritarianism is also very weak. I mean, leadership is very weak. And so essentially they decided, gosh, we have to improve. But they don't know how to lead how. So they tell university presidents throughout China, you need to improve. And they built in some really beautiful incentives to make it happen, but they didn't tell them how. So I think that's where we see that you know, the Chinese are looking elsewhere for leadership insight. Gosh, what can we do? So,
and I'm sure just one last. I've gone this too long, but before Deng Xiaoping began to open up the system, we also had directives coming from central authorities suggesting great leap forwards and getting rid of all the bugs by killing all the, by getting rid of all the birds to get rid of all the birds that were eating all the grain and so forth. We had 30, 40, 50 million people starved to death.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I have a little difficulty conceiving of the possibility that a dictatorship or authoritarian system is going to somehow create all this individualism, and maybe they will let all flowers bloom, but I doubt it.
Chinese economy as an innovation economy has to open up. It has to create, allow, promote individualism, novelty, new ideas, new forms of association internally in China and externally with the rest of the world. They know this. They tell you, especially after a beer, they will tell you this straightforwardly. They're in the same position that the Soviet Union never came out of. At the termination of the Cold War, I was over there a lot working on glasnost and perestroika with American futurists and their prognosticians. And after a couple of vodkas, they would tell you, the reason we can't move forward is we can't communicate with each other, everybody's listening in on us, we can't get access to libraries, et cetera. They were information stars. And the Chinese know that. And so when we mention to them, where is Wikipedia on the web systems in China, that is censored, they're embarrassed. They know that Wikipedia will be there sooner rather than later.
But like also, I'm not so much worried about the Chinese. Because we can think, well, gosh, the Chinese become much more individualistic. Who knows? The bottom line is that they're looking towards the West for leadership and education. And as long as they're looking towards us for leadership on education, then they're a step behind on leapfrog, because they're not leapfrogging us, they're following us. And I think that's just a real pragmatic view of it.
And they know this. And they also know that both the United States and China have another country they should be much more worried about. And that starts with India. That's the country that has the real potential from some viewpoints of becoming the leading knowledge and innovation society of the planet within a reasonable number of decades.
Sure. Representative Welke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the testifiers, first of all, I just want to commend you on focusing on the need for entrepreneurship, because especially as we look at Minnesota's economy, we know that we have to create jobs. And one of the issues that we have is we don't have enough people that are the job creators, the entrepreneurs, the job creators of the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from the community that I represent, we are looking for more entrepreneurs in many different areas, especially in healthcare. And looking at biosciences and the biotechnology. Beyond that, though, I just want to say that I really also commend you on looking at the current K-12 education system and acknowledging that it'll be difficult to make major changes. So I really appreciate the fact that you are putting together a model that hopefully will create the demand, and that demand will create the change. And so hopefully if you can do that and this does take off, I think one of your greatest challenges is going to be, though, finding those volunteers and having a program that's sustainable where those volunteers keep coming back and the excitement's there even when they're not getting paid, because after a while they could really get roped into a program like this, but after a while they're probably going to start asking the question, should I be compensated, when coaches are compensated and others are compensated. But I just want to say that you've come up with a great concept, and I think the demand to lead to the change is something that we haven't really thought of before. I haven't heard of it, at least from people who are talking about high school redesign, where you're creating the demand for the change. So I think that that's a good way to go about it, and focusing on after school and on weekends to get this going, I like that idea. I really do.
Thank you. If I can kind of add on to some stuff. I think that, you know, one of the purposes of education or consequences of education is that we tend to beat creativity out of kids right away. And in a way, we create conformist kids because, you know, that, you know, so that we could fit them into jobs that essentially function as workshops, and not workshops as robots. But that doesn't work anymore. Now we require a workforce that's creative, that is innovative. So we're finding that, you know, from the entrepreneurial approach, I mean, it's one thing to teach kids how to become, you know, Cisco engineers, how to troubleshoot Oracle databases, but it's another thing if the kids start creating the next Ciscos and the next Oracles that propel their local communities. Mm-hmm. And that's where we want to go with LeapFrog.
Now, we see Minnesota as becoming a land not only of 10,000 lakes, but 10,000 creative garages in which the analogs of Jobs and Wozniak and others can work. I just want to say one thing about your discussion about expecting payment for what was volunteer activity. One of the districts we work with just did a straw poll of all of its teachers and found that over 50% were interested in becoming volunteers within a LeapFrog context of extracurricular, that is, nights, weekends, evenings, or rather, summers, and web. Now, let's say that 50% of them actually did volunteer, and we lost a third of them, or two-thirds of them. The pressure would still be there to change the actual delivery system that we've been funding under the industrial model for so many decades. Mm-hmm. And that pressure, frankly speaking, at the local level is what we're hoping does take place.
Representative Welty.
All right, I'm just going to lay out three questions for you, and you can answer them in any order. The first one is, why not other countries? You're only right now focusing on China, and you did mention India, but why aren't you focusing on other countries right now? Second question would be then, kind of going along the lines of what you were talking about, was just focusing on that one school right now in Minnesota. When are you going to start reaching out to the other schools? I realize you're just starting. The program is in its infancy, and you're getting a catalyst going, but if you really want to create the change, are you going to look at a couple more sites this year or next year? And then finally, why are you here? If you're going to be doing this program and you don't need any money, you're going to be relying upon outside sources of income, and you're going to be doing this on weekends and weeknights, you're not going to need any policy from the legislature.
That's right.
Or is there some catch? Is there something that you will want some support on in the future from the
If you want to give us the money to do some of this stuff, of course we would mow your lawn. But I think the thing we were trying to do with our own funding to keep this going is set up a fee structure for participation. Now, would you mind repeating quickly the other two questions?
Like what? Why China?
Why China? Very simple. The Chinese called us up and said, would you come over and talk about LeapFrog at a national conference? That's when we went over last April. That's what happened. We are working with about 7 districts in the Minnesota area around the metro right now. And each district is coming at LeapFrog differently, and we are perfectly happy with that. That's exactly what we would like to see. Mm-hmm. And there was another question.
Well, and then the money catch. When we say no new funding, that's really more of an ideal than it probably is a reality. I think that the reality is that there would probably have to be a little funding here and there, but not. We don't want to emphasize much, because what we want to show is that the real innovation is leveraging what we have to do new things and do better things with that. And so that's really what we're really trying to drive at.
It's sort of like doing more with less.
More different stuff.
Thank you. I just want to make one last point. I know that the business community is here at the table this evening, and I know the business community often stresses that we find innovation, and we change, and we reform the education system. So hopefully they'll be taking this message back to the business community, and the business community will step up and fund this program.
We hope you guys talk to us. Yeah. Because we look to why it's moving.
Any other questions? Any questions from anybody else around the table? Outside of the table?
I guess, what are the elements in the system that are hard to crack to make this something you have to do?
Well, there's the U word.
Pardon?
The union.
Okay.
There's tradition. There's inertia. There's legacy. there's, I went through a certain type of school system, son or daughter, you'll go through the same one. I don't want you coming home with weird ideas. There's a religious factor. There are the textbook companies and the other vested interests that support what are now essentially free textbook opportunities off the web. There's a whole bunch of treadmill stuff going on. And you combine it all together and it presents a front of daunting, diamond-like hardness against change.
Well, just to follow up on that, you know, I work with the union, Minneapolis, Edison Teachers. that one I'd like you to clarify a little bit, because we do have a process going on in Minneapolis trying to free up some stuff, and I think Mr. Caldwell might talk a little bit about that later. But what are the elements that policymakers, which is up to for this committee, and what, and I've been around here for a long time, too long, contribute to that? I guess where I'm coming from is we put kids into classes, age cohorts, we put them into school years, we put them into classrooms, and we put them into all these boxes.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the things that policymakers can do besides the ones you mentioned that they have control over? Because if you read the statutes, there's a lot of things in there that make this system run from year to year to year the same way, that would really help create a system that would be open to redesign.
I think alternatives to licensure would be a major step forward. That is, to somehow parallel the monopoly of the schools of education to licensed teachers with an alternate professionalization and documentation process.
I'm talking the structure of the...
Right, I think the structural core, what we're looking at the cultural issue, is that I think that the one thing that really holds us all back is that we have this idealized image of what education used to be, and gosh darn, wouldn't it be great to contain that and make that happen. When in reality, that's really never happened. We've always been in reform. We've always been trying to catch up. So I think that's a real change. It's a cultural transition from being, you know, real past-oriented in how we view education to being future-oriented. What skills are kids going to need today to get jobs that'll be available in the future? Are we going to train kids for jobs that are available in the 1970s or for jobs that are available in 2025? It's a question we need to be asking ourselves. And then how do we make that happen now? How do we educate kids in that direction today? And that's a huge cultural shift.
I think the policymakers ought to be concerned much, much more than they are about the decline in the relative position of Minnesota educationally in the United States, about the decline in some of our business indices and some other indices that point to quality of life changes. And why are these things happening? What kind of potential redirection can take place in some of those downward tracking trends if we were to use our human capital development resources differently and we were to encourage competition far beyond the school choice, for example? For example, we think the state ought to be able to fund all the way through the end of the bachelor's degree off the tax base. But to do that, you have to start earlier. Kids have to go to college at 16. To go to college at 16, they have to study differently earlier. They won't probably, if they're Americans, memorize any better. We don't think memorization is the future of education anyway. We think the use of information, the creative use of information, is the future. Nobody is really doing that anywhere on the planet. Leapfrog, if you'll read that draft, is all about that. So we think we can be extremely pragmatic in the best sense of Minnesota pragmatism, and extremely visionary in the sense of some of our politicians and others. I make the mention Hubert Humphrey and Paul Wellstone, and no, I'm not a Democrat. I'm independent. And I think part of it is policy, and part of it is ideology, and part of it is straight-out-and-out leadership,
mm-hmm.
taking risks.
Well, thank you very much. This was very interesting, and like I said, tonight we were going to talk about some more radical ideas for redesign, and I think that you have have definitely delivered that. The one thing that I would just like to comment on, and of course it's going to be construed as, you know, going back to the status quo or whatever, but I see where the concepts that you are talking about would be very conducive and would allow some students to be extremely high flyers in certain areas. But once again, when you're in the arena of public, that means every child. And I guess I would have to say, being even just the mother of three, you know, that not one, stressing one or a couple of skills or ways of learning is going to fit all. And so I could see that there are some kids that could really flourish in the leapfrog type academy setting. But I would guess I still always do continue to think that there is a role for a more of a redesigned high school setting where for other kids also to flourish. And the other thing is that, you know, and this sounds really defensive, and I don't mean it to be at all, but, you know, when you have the leapfrog academy, you're educating the children that have been educated to a certain degree already within the public school system.
Mm-hmm.
So you're taking, you know, you're taking the kids that have been taught to do math and to read and all that, and then opening up this whole new layer of thought, thinking, and problem solving, innovation. But I would guess that you still come to the conclusion that you do need those kids to have those basic skills and that type of thing in the earlier years. And maybe not. Maybe that isn't part of your philosophy.
That opens up a whole new discussion.
Right.
I'll make it very, just one sentence. We think there are new basics hanging out there that have not yet been codified very well. These new basics include how to think, how to use software, hardware, how to sort of expand your own mindware into entrepreneurial behavior, and so on and so on. We think that certain advanced technologies can overcome some of the basics that we now understand that cause so many children to become, frankly, demoralized when they fail at subject matters such as math, trigonometry, English, language instruction, physics, and so on. We think that some of these advanced technologies will eliminate that failure. So do the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Simply by letting these devices help the kids pass the test. Because those same types of devices, generically speaking, helped me fly jets in the Air Force. I never could have flown without all the computers around me. They operate the BMW subsystems and so on of all the cars out there on the road. They are built in to all kinds of assumptions about how workforces can be retrained quickly to do new work. We're holding our children back from the access to these technologies.
I'll just add on real quick. So, a quick story. Last year, I accidentally canceled my cable when I was trying to negotiate a better deal. So I end up watching a lot of Chinese TV over the internet, which is how we first got to China, because I got Chinese commercials. And one was for a handheld learning device. I picked up a model I should have brought them with because it scared the wits out of all of us in here. It's kind of like a Palm Pilot type thing, but it's more geared towards learning English and helping kids translate English. It contains 16 dictionaries, plays games. It's a learning tool. Anyhow, the commercial that we saw was a silly kid, you know, he got this device to help him learn English. Great. Showed him taking a test in school using the device, helping him learn English. Showed other kids congratulating him for doing very well in his grades, apparently. But the real kicker on it is that the pitch man for it is a white guy. What the Chinese are telling themselves is that in the United States, we're doing this stuff already. But the reality is we're not. And that's what piqued our interest in China, really.
We're collecting those things at the door.
Yeah.
And, you know, frankly, we have to start looking at tests as more learning options.
Hmm. Well, this has sincerely been thought-provoking, and I thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I'm sure we'll be hearing more from you and the Leapfrog Institute.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Next, I'd like to call on Ted Coldery, Senior Associate, Education Evolving. And this is another testifier that has promised to be thought-provoking.
Well, hard lessons is a hard act to follow. But I'll let me introduce also Tim McDonald, who's a first-year associate with Education Evolving, just less than a year, I guess, out of Hammond. Do I need to say anything more from the record, or for the record, or
you've introduced yourself, and
I'm Ted Coldry. I'm a senior associate with Education Evolving, a little policy group that people have been around Minnesota public education for quite some time. I'd like to put out three propositions pretty quickly here and get your reactions, partly from your own experience in school. First of all, to achieve our national goals, we absolutely need very different models designed to high school that focus on motivation. Secondly, this is possible. Models that maximize motivation are increasingly available to us. And third, Minnesota can do this if it's smart politically. If it simply gets comfortable with the idea that students differ, kids differ, and that it's okay for different folks to be doing different things. Let me take each one of these things in order quickly. The motivation first. I think for a long time, over the last 15 years, for much of the last 15 years, we haven't really appreciated the implications of how fundamentally we changed the assignment to our school. Forever, down to very recent time, their charge was access. To give kids the opportunity to learn, and to extend that opportunity to kids of all physical conditions and kids of all races, and equally to females, and to extend the learning, I mean, extend the leaving year up the grades. The charge was access. And all of a sudden now they are told that the job is achievement, that achievement is imperative. And this is one of these things that's almost too obvious to be noticed. What it means is that effort is essential. If kids have to learn, the question of student effort becomes absolutely central. And if effort is essential, then motivation is essential. And high school, as we've had it down to the present time, is not well organized to maximize motivation, either for students or, I'll say a little bit about this later, for teachers. It is a kind of batch processing. It's organized as courses and classes, and it's group work. The kids come together in a course. The course runs at a certain speed. I've compared it to being like on a bus, 30 kids on a bus. There's a person, an adult on the bus, that points out interesting, important things as the bus rolls along. But if a kid says, I want to stop, I see something interesting, could we stop and go down this road, or could I stop and go down this road? It's just not an opportunity to do that. The course has to move on. It's programmed. So that what Ted Sizer likes to call batch processing, a feature of high school, is a fundamental part of its design. It's a fundamental part of the design problem. The other aspect of the motivation probably has to do with relationships. Beginning not just in high school, but as Grable always reminds me, in secondary school, kids are they begin to take the world becomes courses. The world is divided into disciplines, and disciplines are organized as courses, and courses are organized as classes. And a teacher may see 150 students a day, something like that. And kids are, particularly around our suburban areas, lots of the high schools are 3,000 students, three grade high schools. It's extremely difficult to have close relationships develop students to students or students with teachers in that kind of an arrangement. And policy has concentrated in recent years very heavily on system-level changes, standards and accountability and choice and various other kinds, and accountability, of course. And we've sort of taken it for granted that, that these would somehow translate themselves into different forms of school. And one of the things we're looking at now is we see, as we kind of feel this discouragement and disillusionment around about the slow rate of progress, is that these things by themselves, important as they are, have not followed through in, have not translated into changes in what kids read, see, hear, and do. So this is what brings the question of school redesign to the top. If we mean for all kids to graduate, all kids to learn, and all kids to learn a lot better than they have in the past. Second one, models that maximize motivation are increasingly available. This is not my field. I'm not a curriculum specialist. I'm, Lord knows, not a technology specialist. I just listen to and read some people who are. But some of this has been mentioned. We could individualize high school. It is now possible with the kinds of technologies we have to personalize, customize, individualize learning for students. The batch processing character that, that was developed in a day when the only way to bring knowledge into the classroom was to send in a well-trained person with good books under her arm, important as teachers are, that's no longer the only way to put kids in touch with the world of knowledge. And we don't need to talk about this. Anybody who we all understand this. And we're starting now to learn about virtual environments. Judy Brown at the University of Wisconsin is concentrating very heavily now on mobile learning, as cell phones have turned into the cell phone, now access, this is a computer access. You can get on the internet with a cell phone, and this opens up enormous possibilities. Games, simulations. Our point is, I'm not here to talk about any particular model of school or any particular use of the technology, except to say that it's possible now and it's time now to have an organized program of innovation for American public education. I sort of make a distinction between school and schooling. What I've been talking about, I think, is schooling, the process of putting kids into contact with information and into contact with teachers and what they read, see, hear, and do. And I distinguish that from school in terms of where it is and what it is and how large it is and what role the students and the adults and the young students play in the school. We can innovate on both these things, and we have a fair amount of innovation going on in Minnesota, more than research has identified. I think I can safely say there are schools where relationships have been made very different, where a parent who calls a teacher is recognized by his or her voice, by the teacher, where kids spend not only all day with the same teacher, but all year and even several years with the same teacher, so that those relationships deepen. Third thing is about how to do this politically. I've been really struck as we've been moving around the country, this paper that Tim has run off for you, the Robin Thicke Blue paper, that how deep and powerful this assumption is that if we're going to do something different, everybody has to do it. That we, David Tyack wrote the famous book, One Best System, and there is this sense that we, what we're trying to do is to find the way. And when we find the way, then everybody does it. I guess what we're saying partly in the argument we make in this paper is this is not the way the world works. This is not the way change occurs. There is always a kind of a dominant model, a dominant paradigm. Somebody comes up with something different. This begins to enter the field. For a considerable period of time, the old and the new run along together, each one sort of testing the other. And over time, people make the transition from the old to the new if they want to and when they want to. And ultimately, some new kind of arrangement evolves. Think about anything you know in your own experience. This is the way it's computers replace other kinds of business machines and typewriters, as automobiles replace horses. I mean, it's pervasive. But we don't have this, we don't run this kind of model in education. And what we're basically arguing is that we could operate a split screen program in public education. Minnesota could be a first state to do this. But it would simply take a tolerance for difference and a kind of a deal politically in which the people who are in conventional school and who love conventional school and who want their kids in conventional school, as a lot of people do, get to do that as long as they want, and where we continue to go on trying to improve and develop conventional school. So the new is not imposed on anybody. The other side of the deal being that the people who like conventional school don't try to suppress the innovative. That the people who want something different and are ready for something different and know how are comfortable with something different for themselves and for their children get to do that. And that seems doable. You know? That seems feasible. I was saying to Tim this afternoon, it's basically a good idea to have wheels on both sides of the car. This kind of dual approach is a perfectly doable thing. So what does it come down to in terms of, you know, Rose's question at the end about the policymakers? What do the policymakers do? Public education has not been real welcoming about innovation, and I think you can see that maybe even in recent years it's possible that everything that's gone into the effort, that everything that's gone into No Child Left Behind is in some respects strengthened conventional school rather than opening up, making it easier for people to think about and talk about innovation, about different ways of doing things. There's almost a kind of orthodoxy now conventional objectives. The old, what Art called 19th century or 20th century, last century is now the 20th century, objectives and methods. I used to think about a waiting room. When I thought about innovation, I used to think about a waiting room and a bunch of people in a waiting room with black boxes on their knees. And these were curriculum developers and curriculum specialists and technology people, and each everyone had a new and better way of for kids to learn. And they sat in the waiting room waiting for the door to open. They just knew that if they could get inside and see the people who made the decisions, that the people would want to have this. But the door never opened, and gradually the waiting room became filled with cobwebs, and the dust settled on these black boxes. And that was my picture of this. It has not been an opening, a welcoming. So the job for policy people and for legislators is to open the system. I make just three things that go into this. One is to legitimize being different in ways I've kind of discussed. I don't need to say more about this. We did a meeting out at Menlo Park at the Hewlett Foundation offices in September, and had some people in there who've been mixed up with the Partnership for 21st Century Skills. Karen Cater, who has education for Apple. I think the NEA is very involved in Partnership for 21st Century Skills. And a lot needs to be done, as Mike Cohen was reminding us, to give concreteness to that, about what the old objectives really are, beyond a little litany of good-sounding words like creative and analytical and so forth, and to find practical ways to assess quality and accomplishment, you know, towards those objectives. But the biggest thing is just to say it's okay to be different. The second thing is to open the institution. And Minnesota, again, was a pioneer in this, has opened it up, created what we like to refer to as an open sector within public education, not going outside public education, where it's possible for people to create new schools that can be different. Minnesota's policy has been to give districts the opportunity to have this kind of open sector internally, and a number of districts have, and they can, and they should continue to improve that opportunity for these innovations to appear and develop in new schools. Now, the final thing, which kind of builds off that last one, is we really think it would make a lot of sense for the state to be encouraging, for legislators, policymakers, to be encouraging arrangements in which the teachers can be in charge of this whole transition in schooling. Which really, pretty much that the teachers have an opportunity, if they want, to run the school, to take the responsibility, to carry the authority, and to carry the responsibility for the school's success. Rose made a little mention of this earlier. I remember being in this room 3 years ago when the legislature was enacting a little amendment to the school-based decision-making law that creates these so-called self-governed schools, with the concept that the self-governed could be the kind of professional arrangement that it is in every other occupational area we call professional: auditing, accounting, law, medicine, consulting, architecture, engineering, whatever, where the professionals run the show and have the administrators working for them. This, again, it brings you back to the importance of ideas and the traditional pictures we carry in our heads. You know, we have this notion of the public bureau so deeply implanted in education, this kind of paramilitary kind of organization. Administrators pay twice as much as professional teachers or more now that the cap has come off. It doesn't have to be like that, and there are, again, innovations, experiments that have begun in Minnesota that are being replicated in other states now, that beginning to validate the arrangement. You might want to go back and wait and take a look. There are certain problems we don't need to get into tonight as to why this law hasn't been implemented already in Minneapolis, where it was, for which I think it was originally intended, but this could be done. But this is a half a trillion dollar industry in this country, is education, and it just does not make basic sense to operate this industry of all, this institution, without a major component of technological and organizational innovation running inside of SRB. We'd be glad to talk with you further about this. Be glad to help you if you want to work on this. But for the moment, that's my essential pitch.
Thank you, Mr. Caldrey. This seems to be the buzzword for tonight: innovation. thank you. Members, do you have any questions? Anybody else around the table have any questions? Go ahead, sir.
My name's Tom Abels. I'm an ex-academic. I helped take a university from a junior college all the way up to graduate school many years ago before I resigned tenure and walked out. I edit a journal called On the Horizon, which deals with the futures of education. And I'm in the process right now of developing with a group of people a virtual charter school for the state of Minnesota. We can talk about that and some of the team we're putting together. But I have to support, Art and I have had long, long, long discussions. I have to support what Art says. And you've asked for some concrete to reform high school. One concrete I can ask right now is that the state should give back what it took away. Many years ago, the universities used to have experimental high schools. One of those was Wilson, which was affiliated with the University of Minnesota Mankato, back when it was called Mankato State. It was run by a gentleman called Don Glein. He ran a 24x7x365 ungraded charter school, a school. It lasted for 7 years until the experimental schools and the wisdom of the state were shut down. And the university high school in Minnesota is now a small business center, and Wilson is gone. If you're talking about trying to create innovation and experimentation, give the universities the opportunity to have a place to try a lot of these ideas. The second is, you're talking P16 or P20, some people are even talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have entrance exams to go from grade school to middle school or junior high, whatever the term is, or from junior high to high school. In some states, you do have to, or some places, you do have to take a test to get into a particular high school in larger cities where they have specialized programs. The question is, why is there an entrance exam to get into the University of Minnesota or any state university? It should be a continuous path, and it should not be the university's dictation of what you have to do to get in. It should be the university's function to work with all the way down to P to make sure that those are continuous. My kids were in a private school. Everybody in the high school knew exactly what the pre-K kids in the private school were doing. There was an interrelationship working all the way through. And until that interrelationship happens, you're going to have what Ted and Art have both argued against, which is cohorts, age-graded cohorts. You can't do a charter school in Minnesota and admit kids based on capability. There is no pre-testing. You have to take them in an age-delivered cohort. Yet we all know some kids learn math quicker, some kids learn English quicker. Why do you march them lockstep, as Ted talked about, put them on a bus and move them forward? Why can't they move at the rate at which they're moving? The third is that Art has talked about volunteers. Service learning is something that is required at the University of Minnesota. It is seen in high schools and other places. You have an army of kids who want to work with other kids. And therefore, the idea of creating service learning. The other piece is, and I'm looking at the charter schools because I just came back from a pre-charter school indoctrination program in order that you can apply to start a charter school. And charter schools started in a very creative
way. Sir, I hate to interrupt you, but we are on a time limit. You have a question?
Yeah, the question is,
I'm sorry.
Why can't the legislature listen to these people and instead of thinking about, well, this can't be done, why doesn't the legislature say, how can we do this? How can we help? What Art is talking about in China is happening in Iowa. DMAC has got classes on cell phones. Europe has global cloud-based computing. It's just the United States thinks it is not moving, and it's not. So the question is, why do we question innovation? Why don't we legislate opportunities for innovation?
That's
about what?
Very good challenge. And actually, I've kind of felt like that's what we were here tonight doing, is listening. And I think that it has opened everybody's mind up a bit. Thank you very much. Any other questions?
I'm just going to add one quick comment to what I said. Art was talking earlier about how different things were in the era of the agricultural era. If you think about Nesbitt's farmer to worker to clerk, simplified story of the evolution of our society and economy. There's another kind of thing that happened in the agricultural time, because work and ownership were combined. And when work and ownership were combined, innovations get taken up very rapidly. Again, if you look back at the American family farm in this part of the country, because better seed, better cropping, better practices, better equipment made farming both more profitable and more pleasant, easier at the same time. And so, over the period of a fairly short period of time, the proportion of the population in America involved in agriculture dropped from, 50% down to whatever it is, 5% or less than that today.
1%.
This enormous increases in productivity. And what I was saying at the end about the self-governed school, see, is the opportunity essentially of combining work and ownership at the school level in a coherent group of responsible professional teachers. I'll bet you that if you did that, you'd find innovation developing very rapidly. And we think we do see something like this in the cases that we're now looking at. One of the students are workers on the job of education. And if you're going to redesign high school, you want to make the students the workers. But Yankelovich has a really nice concept about discretionary efforts. In all organizations, the people who work in them, there's a level of effort they can give you if they want, an additional level of effort they can give you if they want. Your job in managing organizations or in designing organizations and institutions is to create opportunities and incentives. An incentive is a reason combined with an opportunity for people to elicit that level of discretionary effort. And we could get lots more than we're getting out of both our students and our teachers. The nice thing about it is that any effort we get, any additional effort we get from the students, comes for free. Students. Okay. So.
Yes. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
As I said earlier, thought-provoking ideas. We are going to have one other meeting in the interim here, and it will focus on somebody from the state of Washington who has focused on high school redesign for over 10 years in the state of Washington. So that will be, I believe, our final meeting. And we're not sure. I don't think we have a final date yet, but I believe that we're going to shoot for next Tuesday. So for tonight, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.